Equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We've got a great show coming up for you today, concentrating mostly on the food side of things, but you can never entirely separate these, and indeed we won't. We'll also be talking about the local economy and even how to live without money entirely. We've got some exciting guests for you coming up. First guest is Maddie Harland. She edits the Permaculture magazine published in the United Kingdom. The latest issue includes an article by a man who's lived without money for more than a year, as well as ways of speaking so people listen to you and how to prepare for when the power goes out, which is kind of apropos as we enter a Vermont winter here. Then in the second half of the show, one of my favorite guests, Sharon Astick. She'll be back talking about her latest book called Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation. As we approach the holiday season, it's nice to talk about gifts that we could be giving to ourselves or to our friends and family. And I think a subscription to Permaculture magazine or Sharon Astick's latest book or one of her other two would make great gifts. So I'm happy to have them on as guests today. Before we get into talking with Maddie, I want to mention that there's a lot of talk about eating seasonally, eating the things that are available in season, and then storing things to extend seasons later on. I travel seasonally. When I come from my home in East Montpelier to the studio here in Waterbury, in the warm parts of the year, I will often bicycle one way and then take the bus back to Montpelier with my bicycle on the rack in the front on the way home, and then bicycle the rest of the way home. Or I'll just take the motorcycle. I got my first motorcycle in my life in August, 90 miles per gallon, have been enjoying it a lot. I'll take that the whole way. But with this snowy weather, it's kind of unappealing to be bicycling the full 16 miles, and I'm not sure about riding the motorcycle with salt on the roads and corroding it, and also just not having snow tires on it. So I started taking the Jack Donovan Express again. I bicycle down to Montpelier and meet Jack on his way into the station, and then at the end of the show I take the bus back to Montpelier where my bike's waiting for me, and bike home from there. I do miss the bike ride. And it does mean getting here some hours earlier than I normally would in the morning, but I've got plenty to do here. The good folks at WDEV have a desk for me that I can use, and I enjoy spending the time with Jack in the car, which I don't normally do when I just arrive here under my own locomotion. So, like all of life, it's trade-off, and eating seasonally, traveling seasonally, they both put you in touch with the seasons. I'm glad to have that snow for the beginning of the winter. Anyway, we are going to be talking with someone who lives in a different climate from us, Maddie Harland, editor of Permaculture magazine, calling to us from the United Kingdom, from England. Maddie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, we talk about permaculture a fair amount on this show, but it's always good to, it's still a kind of an unusual word. Could you just remind us what permaculture is and then tell us what you're trying to do with the magazine?
Sure. Permaculture is a contraction of two words, permanent agriculture, but increasingly also permanent culture. And the idea is to develop a very practical framework or method for creating ecologically harmonious, efficient and productive systems. And this could be a house and garden, an apartment, a farm, or a community scale initiative. Even a publishing company can be designed with permaculture principles. And permaculture is very much about what you personally can do as an individual. It's not a design methodology for experts. It's a real level playing field, and it's very accessible, and it can be used by anyone, anywhere, in any climate.
Hmm. And so you have this magazine, Permaculture magazine, which comes out quarterly, correct?
That's right, and it's actually available now in 77 countries. We have subscribers all over the world, and then we have distribution in North America through stores and health food shops and bookshops. So we publish Permaculture magazine. We also publish books as well about permaculture and solar energy and a lot of subjects that you'd probably expect from us. And they're actually distributed in the States by Chelsea Green in Vermont. They're our American partners.
And we interviewed one of your authors, John Paul Flintoff, I believe it was last week, who
That's
wrote
right.
Through the Eye of a Needle about how he searched for meaning in life through religions and other things and ended up finding the meaning and making his own underwear.
Among other projects.
And other clothes.
Exclusively
yes.
Underwear, but, you know, other sort of self-made sewing projects. He's a fantastic guy, very funny. And I loved that book, which is why when he offered it to me, I said we'd love to do it, because fundamentally he's funny as well as highly intelligent, interesting man.
He is. Now, I was going to ask you what relevance people in the U.S. would find for this permaculture magazine published in the United Kingdom, but you say it's available in 77 countries, so let me broaden that question a bit.
Well, it's really a magazine about new ideas and also reviving things that are absolute common sense, traditional ideas as well. It's a sort of combination of, you know, the wisdom of our forebears, but also new innovation as well and new thinking. So it is about how to live a more creative, happier life, and we don't see sustainability as something that's about what you have to lose and what you have to give up. We see it as definitely a change in thinking and in lifestyle, but really a enhancement of lifestyle and something that's ultimately creative and positive. So we have articles you mentioned in your introduction about this guy Mark Boyle, who had an experiment to live for a whole year without money through something called the free economy, which is a movement that's built hugely in the UK through internet technology, through websites who allow people to exchange goods and barter in the UK. And it's his story. It's a very inspiring story. So much so, he's had such a good year, he's going to carry on. We also have articles about the transition movement, which was started in Ireland but is now all over the world, and it's in the States as well. So that's the first survey of the UK transition movement, but there's much that can be learnt from that survey by people interested in transition, and this is transition from a fossil fuel economy into a post oil economy, into a sort of new way of living and working together. And that's as relevant to people in the US and New Zealand as it is to someone in London. There's all sorts of stuff in here. There's stuff about sustainable beekeeping. I know in the States you've got plummeting bee colony loss, and that you've actually had to import bees from Australia. Same is true in Europe. And actually, someone read this article and actually built the hive described in it in Africa. So we like to feel that we can appeal and engage with people all over the world that are looking for new ideas and positive ways of living, and that we're not just appropriate for the British shores. But of course, we are British, so it's going to have a little bit of an English feel to it.
Well, I was reading the.
You'll find that charming.
I was reading the article about how to get by when the electricity goes out and having to figure out exactly what a water cylinder is, and I guess it's what we call a hot water tank.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there will be some linguistic challenges, but not too many, we hope. And in fact, we do have an increasing amount of American authors, and we certainly don't go around changing their spelling into English. We like to keep the voices of the people who are writing for us.
Well, on our website, there's a link to your website. Our website is equaltimeradio.com, so anyone who wants to find out more about it can go to today's story with a link directly to Permaculture Magazine's website, and then when the audio is up from this show in a day or two, I hope, then that link will be connected with the audio. When they go to your, I don't remember, when they go to your website, will they find out how to subscribe in the United States, or are we dependent on going to bookstores to find permaculture?
Oh, no, you can subscribe direct to us in the UK.
Okay.
And you can actually even subscribe to an online version, if you like, as well, because we exist in a paper format, which people love.
It's gorgeous.
But we also, particularly for people in other parts of the world, to keep costs much lower, provide an online example. And indeed, when you go to the Permaculture Magazine website, you'll find a link for a free online sample copy where you can sit and read a recent magazine, and just to get an idea of what we're like, really.
Just having an issue in my hand, it's high production quality, glossy paper, lots of beautiful pictures, and in this this European size paper, the A4, which is a little bit narrower and taller than our 8.5 by 11 paper.
That's right.
Very well done.
But I will add that it's also maybe glossy, but it's Forage Stewardship Council certified paper, and it's printed with soybean inks, and it's got 50% recovered waste. So we're really careful as a publisher about the resources that we use, and we very much like to walk our talk, you know. So it's high quality, but it's eco-high quality.
And are those organically raised soybeans?
Well, soybeans are very difficult to, I don't know, actually. You caught me out there. Well done. And I can't even say whether they're U.S. soybeans. And, of course, if they're U.S. soybeans, they may well be GM.
Right. Genetically modified, which means they're not organic. Oh, well, can't be perfect.
Well, I'll have to check that out, actually. I really will.
Okay. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Maddie Harland. She's over in England. She's the editor of Permaculture Magazine. You can find a link to that at our website, equaltimeradio.com. Want to go back to this article that we both mentioned now and talk about it a little bit more in depth, just to give people an idea of what's in the latest issue of Permaculture Magazine. Living Without Money is the name of the article. And one just charming little British thing I liked about it is that articles about money in this country, we often replace S's with dollar signs. And of course, you have a pound there, so the L in Living Without Money is replaced with a pound sign. Very nice. But Mark Boyle, he decided to live a life without money, and as far as I can tell from the article, he began his year without some of the very basic things like shelter, like a source of food, like a source of heat, and he went and scrounged them without paying anything for them.
Yeah, so the trouble is with the word scrounge is it sounds like he's a kind of free loader, but what he actually did was he connected in with a website which is part of a movement called the Free Economy in the UK, and through that he was able to obtain a small mobile home. And then this guy is actually a professional man, but he decided to site that on an organic farm, and in exchange for being able to site his home there, he exchanged 3 days of his time in lieu of rent. So, you know, he's someone that is bartering and making exchanges within his community. He's not kind of sitting there with his hand out expecting people to give him things unconditionally.
Mm. And he mentioned that if he'd been using that time, those 3 days that he spent working on the organic farm, earning money in his professional occupation, then it could be considered a sky-high rent for just a place to rent and to place an old trailer.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then he set about sort of kitting himself up so that he could cook, and he built himself a compost loo, and he created a vegetable garden and became proficient at foraging for food. And he also tapped into his community resources so that if he needed something, he could make exchanges and barter as well. So he is a resourceful, intelligent person, I have no doubt, and a very eloquent writer.
Mm.
I really like his perception about how consumers are in a way numbed or cut off from where the stuff that they're buying comes from. And I think that goes for all of us who use money. Money becomes a sort of, in a way, a barrier for us to see over, to see where we get things from, unless we really go out and educate ourselves about where our food comes from, the clothes we're wearing, etc., etc. So the reason he did this was because he wanted to become extremely conscious of where his necessary life's resources were coming from, and he wanted to control them as well and live in as low impact and ethical way as possible.
And he's still using things that came from far away, maybe produced under conditions that were pretty unpleasant for the people producing them, like the olive oil cans that he used to make into a rocket stove. But he's not generating any demand for those things because he's not paying money for them. He's getting them as cast-offs or, as you mentioned, bartering with people.
Yeah, and I mean, he said that he had to buy a solar panel at the beginning of his experiment because he did need some energy. You know, he couldn't just live, in darkness in the winter. But he makes a very interesting comment. He says, "I believe that money is a bit like oil in that respect. If we have to use it, let's at least use it to build sustainable ways of living." Mm. And I think that's a key issue. Not all of us can just go out, live in a caravan, grow vegetables, and walk away from our professional and our family lives. I've got 2 children, and I need to support them through college. But I can still make very distinct choices about what I choose to consume and, where I buy my stuff from, effectively. So this article's it's a great story, but it's also there to stimulate all of our readers into thinking about how they choose to vote with their pocketbook.
Mm. And you do want your readers to keep earning money so they can subscribe to Permaculture Magazine.
Or read the online sample copy for free.
Right.
on their barter laptop.
And I take it you didn't pay Mark Boyle for his article.
What do you think?
Well, I noticed that you pay for everything by bartering for books. Is that correct?
Well, we do, or we make exchanges with people for advertising. We usually find ways of making creative exchanges.
Right.
One
of the questions that people in Vermont face trying to eat locally is, where do we get the cooking oils to use? So for someone like Mark Boyle, who is not interested in earning money to buy cooking oils from far away, do you know what he did for things like that that are hard to get locally where he lives in the UK?
Well, we can grow certain oils because we can grow rapeseed oil in the UK, and we can use something out of a cow called butter to cook with as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that he probably very sparingly used both.
We're talking with Maddie Harland. She is the editor of Permaculture Magazine, published quarterly in the United Kingdom, and you can subscribe to it in this country. Let's talk about one of the other articles in the current issue, the number 62. You mentioned at the beginning of our talk, Maddie, that a publishing company can be run on permaculture principles. And Rob Hopkins, pretty much the founder of the Transition Town movement, has an article here on applying permaculture principles to businesses, which has a lot of, you know, abstract ideas on how to do it. I'm wondering if you can help us by saying concretely within your publishing company how you apply permaculture principles.
Well, we're very proud with our publishing company. It's been we're just about to go into our 20th year, and last year we won the Queen's Award for Enterprise for Sustainable Development. So we actually went to Buckingham Palace and were given an award by the Queen for our best practice in sustainability. So our whole company is designed with permaculture principles, and that means that it is quite resilient, it's quite lean, and we're really careful about how we use our resources and our energy within the company. So it is true that this is a very practical system. I think Rob's article is highly stimulating, but it can be translated into very practical daily actions. Like, for instance, we don't have a waste collection at our company. We have a very vigorous system of recycling. We use an awful lot of the packaging and paper that we generate as a company. We compost our kitchen waste from lunch. We even compost our shredded paper and use it in our permaculture garden, the compost, I mean. So we're really very, very careful about not creating waste. We run the company we have a solar photovoltaic array on the roof. We have solar hot water, and our actual offices are heated by a wood chip boiler that's based on the site at the Sustainability Center. So we make great efforts to be as ecological and ethical as possible. I mentioned that the paper we use is certified as an environmental standard, and the magazine's printed with Sawyer ink. Our printer of the magazine has recently won an award for being one of the greenest and most responsible printers in the UK. So we're really careful with the resources that we buy in to enable us to function as a company, and also what we then create as products and give or, you know, supply to our customers.
In this country, at least, I imagine in the UK, people talk about the triple bottom line, the regular economic bottom line, and then bottom line in terms of social performance and environmental performance.
Exactly. And the Queen's Award actually is the whole assessment of the company is based on your capacity to be functioning as an economically profitable business, an ecologically sound business, and also as an enterprise that contributes to your local environment as well.
Are there any decisions that you know,
not just about making money or just being green. You have to also make a contribution to your local community.
Are there any decisions that you've made in the last year or two that were difficult because they might have improved the social or the environmental bottom line, but really cut into your economic bottom line?
Well, put it this way. I've been very, very keen to ride out this recession and retain staff, even when some parts of the year, perhaps from an economic point of view, I should have been ruthless as a company owner and manager, but I wasn't prepared to do that, no. And there are times where we constantly make a decision, which is an investment decision, where we don't print any of our books in the Far East or China and then ship them in. We print to support our printing industry in the UK. And we do this very deliberately. One, because our companies that we work with can verify that the paper and the inks used are genuinely sourced from the sources that are they claim to be. We know that their employment policies are ethical and they take care of their staff. And also because we don't believe, as an environmental company, we should be buying products from the other side of the world and then shipping them into the UK, which is our prime market. You know, we believe that we've got to support our economy.
Mm. Well, I was at a session on leadership last week in which I was told about a leadership consultant who was just trying out something new with the business executives that he was working with, and he asked them, have any of you made a decision that went against your core values? And there was generally a nodding around the room, and he asked, well, what did it cost you? And there was silence, and one of them said, well, it cost me the respect of my children. And another one said, well, it cost me my marriage. So there can be heavy costs to be paid by not looking at other bottom lines and economic bottom lines.
We really do, but, you know, we cannot in all conscience do things that fly in the face of the ethics and principles of permaculture. It would make us just generators of paper.
Hmm.
And one of the things that we try to do, and we are human, so we're never going to be 100% perfect, but we try very hard in our personal lives. I run this company with my husband. We try very hard in our personal lives to live by these ideas. And, you know, we grow food and live in a eco house, and we're part of a community here. You know, it's a traditional English village, but we also work hard at the Sustainability Centre, which is an educational not-for-profit, and we volunteer our time for that not-for-profit as well. And so we really do try to live with integrity and not say to people, you know, do as I say and then not do it ourselves.
Maddie Harland is editor of Permaculture Magazine, published 4 times a year. Maddie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to Permaculture Magazine's website, where you can subscribe to either the online or the print edition, at our website, equaltimeradio.com. I'm Carl Etnayer. We'll be back in just a minute to talk with Sharon Astick. She is a homesteader and prolific writer, a repeat guest on Equal Time Radio. Her latest book is Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation. Back after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer, your Monday host. My theme, as usual, is food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about food, how to preserve it, how to store it, and why to do that. Our guest is Sharon Astick. She's the author of a number of books. We've had her on several times over the last couple of years. Her latest book is called Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation. It's out in time for the holidays. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, independent from what?
Well, I think from a whole host of things. Certainly dependence on fossil fuels for agriculture. We all know the statistic. We use 10 calories of oil for every calorie of food we put in our mouths. Certainly independent from the corporations that we rely on to provide us with a lot of our food. We get it prepackaged. It comes pre-canned. You know, it's set up for us. And of course, we're giving money to those corporations who then use that money to lobby for agricultural policy and for food safety policies that don't necessarily benefit us. Freedom from things like bisphenol A, which is inside every canned good that you eat and which has been linked to breast cancer and to erectile dysfunction for men and a whole bunch of other nasty things. Freedom from a whole host of problems of industrial food system, independence from, you know, from the risks of the industrial food system. I mean, it's not, what is it, in the last few years we've had botulism in chili, melamine in dog food, you name it. So it's a chance, it's an independence in the sense that you know where your food comes from and what's in it.
Hmm. And this book is a little bit different than some of your earlier works because you're emphasizing the food storage and preservation, saying you don't have to have a garden, you don't have to be a farmer in order to be putting food aside.
Yeah, after Aaron Newton and I wrote A Nation of Farmers, which is the book before this one, where we spent a lot of time asking the question, can we feed the world? Can we feed ourselves locally? Can we create an ethical food system? This book kind of followed out of that, and it came a lot down to this question of, okay, we've concluded that we can, but how do we help people actually do it? And there's so much interest in local food and local eating, but a lot of us, particularly up where we live in cold climates, we have an easy time buying local food, and we have an easy time coming by local food 20 weeks a year, maybe from June to October. But then how do we do it the rest of the year? And, of course, the answer to that is we preserve food, and we build up a pantry, and we eat ethically. You know, we buy things locally, or we learn to preserve what we've grown, or all those things. But we've lost that skill set, I think.
Hmm. And you have in this book, Independence Days, a guide to sustainable food storage and preservation, you have tips for setting aside food, say, for emergency situations. Right here, we're entering winter and thinking about ice storms that might leave us without power for a day or a week, or gosh, up in Canada a decade ago, it was 6 weeks in some places. And you're saying you don't even need a lot of skill sets to start doing that. You can go to the supermarket and start buying things.
Exactly. Obviously, I would prefer people didn't. I'd prefer people put up local food, that they grow some of their own, that they source it from the best possible organic sources and things. But realistically, I know that a lot of people have no money. There are a lot of people out of work. There are a lot of people for whom just getting a reserve of food, of any kind of food, is an essential project, because we certainly all remember the ice storm last year, and of course the Canadian ice storm not that long ago, which was so long. We remember, you know, in Kentucky they had that ice storm where people couldn't get to the grocery store for 3 weeks. We had Hurricane Rita, we've had Hurricane Katrina, you name it. Nearly every region of the country has had a reason in the last few years to remember why it is that the American Red Cross and FEMA and everybody else say that Americans need to take some responsibility for themselves and have a reserve of food and water. Now, the minimum they recommend is 2 weeks of food and water. But I go on and suggest that people build up enough food for 3 months, whether they have to do it by spending $5 a week at their supermarket in very small increments, or they can afford to do more and use it better sources. Either way, everybody needs a reserve of food.
Hmm. And in this book, you have very many reasons to be putting food aside, and we just talked about one of them. You talk early on about the connection between the welcoming table and the full pantry. Could you talk a little bit about that? And I'm thinking, you know, pantry is maybe not a word that everybody knows. Maybe you can explain what that is.
Sure, your pantry is just where you're keeping your food storage. And I actually think one of the wonderful things is you don't actually have to have a pantry. Now, if you're lucky enough to have an old farmhouse that comes with a pantry, that's really awesome. But most of us don't. We probably have, a lot of people live in apartments, a lot of people live in modern houses that weren't built with such a thing. And so it's easy to make a pantry out of a closet, out of a little space under the stairs, out of a little bit of extra space in your house. But pantry is just where you keep your extra food.
Okay. And what's the connection between having that pantry full and the welcoming table?
Well, I think a lot of us have forgotten how important it is to sort of invite people in for meals. We feel like entertaining is this big production, because we see it on TV all the time. You watch the Food Channel, and you've got to make these appetizers that take 3 hours and that involve, you know, taking out a second mortgage on your house to afford the ingredients. And that's crazy. A lot of what we most need to do is to sit down with the people in our lives, our neighbors, our friends, our family, and just eat with them simple, basic, inexpensive food. And a lot of us are struggling to get along, and we can do this when there's always some food in the pantry. That means if somebody comes over with their kids and you can throw some extra noodles in the soup and there's enough to go around. It means if somebody comes around taking donations for the food pantry, you've got something to offer. It means that there's always something to share as well as enough for yourself. And that's a big deal right now. I mean, we've just seen that 1 out of every 9 Americans needs food stamps, and how tough it can be to get get by on food stamps, and that one out of every five American children went hungry last year.
Hmm. Well, I tried something similar when I was in my 20s with beer, and it didn't work out all that well. I was living in a dry county in Arkansas, and you know, it's hard to get your hands on beer if you're in a dry county. You have to bring it in from outside the county.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure that I always had enough beer on hand so that no matter how many people came and how long they stayed, we wouldn't run out of beer. Well, some of my friends who were in their 20s, they thought of this as a challenge. And so we had some pretty wild parties that way, but and we never did run out of beer. It was a physical law. It did make some pretty deep hits in the beer inventory sometime. Do you ever find that with a full pantry?
Sure. I mean, we've had weeks where we've had a lot of guests and things like that. I mean, now at this point, I've got a fairly solid reserve built up. But we do find ourselves running out of things like, oh gosh, you know, we have, you know, around the holidays, particularly when people have a lot of parties and a lot of celebrations, it does, you know, it does mean a challenge occasionally. But I mean, one of the advantages of this is if you do keep a reserve of the things you eat most often, sort of the basic staple foods of your diet, you just don't have to go to the store as much. And that's really nice when you're, you know, all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, there's 17 people coming to dinner.
Mm. Hmm. Well, here we are in the beginning of December. I'm happy to have you on to advertise your book, Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation, in time for people to get it for themselves or for their family or friends for Christmas. But realistically, we're past the growing season here for almost everything. Where would you advise people to start this time of year?
Yeah, it's tough to be selling this, you know, not in, you know, July when everybody can be making jam. But you know what? There's a lot people can still do. I mean, out near me, the farmers, you know, the potato farmers and such are selling bulk vegetables, root vegetables that store really beautifully, very inexpensively. For all those families that are having such a tough time getting by right now, you know, 50 pounds of potatoes for 12 or 13 or 15 bucks is a pretty good deal. And mm-hmm. right now is the perfect time to set up a root cellar. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have an old house, you may have a basement that's really suitable for storing food. But even if you have a newer house or even an apartment, you may well have a spot that stays cold but doesn't freeze, and that's really all you need. I use an unheated porch because my basement is too wet. I know people who keep their food in their attic, in a closet where they've cut a vent in the wall. I know people who keep them in old coolers on their porch outside, just keep them locked so the bears can't get them. And, you know, it's really very simple. So, and squash and sweet potatoes, if you can get those locally, those things stay pretty much at the same temperatures that we all do. So if you keep a cool house, you keep your house around 50, 60 degrees, you could just put them under the bed in your guest room or, you know, in your closet, and they'll be there for months.
Hmm. And here in Waterbury, where we're broadcasting from, there is a winter farmers market. I just saw the posters for it today. Once a month through, I think, April. I should have noted down the date for the December one, but it's coming right up. Montpelier last year had a winter farmers market twice a month, I believe. I don't know whether they're repeating it at that frequency this year. If I do know, the winter farmers market will be starting up again this month. So you can go to that and get these local vegetables. Maybe it's your first time root cellaring. You can try it on a small scale with what you buy in from the local farmers and see how it goes. If it works well, then you can buy in larger quantities next year and use the same space.
Exactly. And the other thing is, I mean, if you're putting up food right now, you've got some stuff in the root cellar, there's some other preserving that you could experiment with along the course of the winter. For example, you know, we put up our apples in the root cellar, and as the apples start to get a little soft, that's a good time to start making applesauce, and then we can can that right up. The same thing with, you know, if my pumpkins start getting to be around the end, it's time to make pumpkin pie, but I've got some extra. I can dehydrate it and make pumpkin leather, like fruit leather, or, you know, can some pumpkin up. And that's a really good way, as you're going, to keep this sort of process going all year round, but also to experiment with something, you know, that would otherwise go to waste anyway.
We've got a caller on the line. We're going to Warren DeShawn. Hello, Sean.
How are you doing? Just a great show, and just wanted to chime in on the market, because I heard you were wondering about the Montpelier Farmers Market, and
yeah.
I do know for sure that they are doing the market two dates every month for the winter, and I believe it's the first and the third Saturday of the month.
Okay, first and third Saturday, that's up at Vermont College again this year, right? At the gym.
And it's December through April.
Okay. Thanks very much for the information.
You bet.
Sharon Astick, author of Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation, you write towards the back of this book about the community resources and have a little section titled, But Won't Someone Just Take My Food Away From Me? Addressing people's fears of hordes of refugees in time of crisis coming and taking the food. And you pretty much knock that idea down pretty well. But I'm wondering, looking at it the other way, I think a lot of people have a hard time changing the way they do something as basic as cooking food by buying a book, no matter how well written it is, and reading it, sitting down and following its instructions. I think that teams of people working together have a better chance of making fundamental changes like that. And I know you work with teams through courses that you teach online. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of times it's really very overwhelming, because if you're going to start storing food in your pantry, you're also going to start eating this kind of food. You're going to start eating the foods that probably store well. A lot of times you're going to be shifting, for example, from buying processed foods to sort of eating whole grains and legumes and things like that. And it's all very good for you, and it's all very tasty, and it's all very wonderful. But it can be really hard to know where to stop. And I agree completely that this is one of those things that's much easier to do with other people. I've certainly taught online classes about how to get started with this, and it can be as basic as, where do I get the food? What do I do with it when I've got it? How do I keep it from bugs from getting into it? How do I, you know, how can I make jam? How can I do these basic things? And I've actually taught in-person classes where people come to learn, you know, something, because, you know, something like a pressure canner or a dehydrator can seem a little overwhelming when you get it. I also really encourage people to make use of whatever community resources you've got. I mean, a lot of times CSAs or farmers markets will include canning information. Your cooperative extension may teach canning classes. There should be a lot of things local to people if they want to start learning about how to do this stuff. And I do encourage people, if they have this skill set out there, and I know there are a lot of folks in Vermont who've been doing this a lot longer than I have, who to say, okay, let me invite the neighbors in. Maybe I'm getting older and it's hard for me to put up quite as much food as I used to have. Let me see if any of my neighbors would like to share in the work and maybe learn how to do it at the same time.
Hmm. And around here we have places like Hunger Mountain Co-op in Montpelier that seems almost every night has some sort of class related to food preservation or herbal medicine or some other skill like that. And there are many other places around here that are offering such courses, Rhapsody Cafe in Montpelier. So there is a wealth of local offerings so you can get hands-on experience. Now, the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, have, I don't know if it's something written in the Book of Mormon or if it's just an ethos that they've developed, but food preservation is an essential part of their religious culture, and having up to a year's supply of food on hand. Have you worked with that community at all, or learned from them, or are there other religious traditions that that are keyed into storing and preserving food?
Absolutely. I have, in fact, you know, I have a number of Mormon readers who have passed on information, and in fact, on my blog, I fairly regularly do something that I call Friday Food Storage Quickies, because I got this great idea from one of my Mormon readers. They said at their church, what happens is every Saturday, somebody stands up with the announcements at the church and says, this week, we're going to pick up tuna fish, or, and here's the sale flyer from the local grocery store, or this week, we're going to add sugar and salt to our food preservation. And the people really respond really well for having a concrete suggestion for this is how you could go at it. And I've started doing that on my blog. Is this week, you know, last week, for example, we started putting together the ingredients to make lentil soup, lentils and onions and carrots, so that you'd be able to make soup come wintertime, you know. And it's very simple stuff, but I think it's easier than being given this gigantic shopping list and saying, well, you need to accumulate all these things. It can be as simple as, let's go pick up an extra package when we're at the store or at the farmer's market this week. We also, there's an online, if you Google Mormon's food storage calculator, there's an online research that will tell you how much a year's supply is for your family. Now, not everybody wants to store a whole year's worth of food, but you can then divide it by in half or by thirds or whatever to show whatever how much food you would like to store and how much that would actually be.
I'm Carl Entner. You're listening to Equal Time here on WDEV. Our guest is Sharon Astick, the author of Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation. There's a link to the blog that Sharon was just talking about on our website at equaltimeradio.com. And I'll look around for this Mormon food storage calculator and put a link up there for that as well. There's also a link to the publisher's website for her book, Independence Days. One of the things that I'm fascinated by on your blog and in this book, Sharon Astick, is the idea of doing something every day for raising food and storing food. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think the thing that probably keeps people from getting started at preserving and storing food is this idea that it's just going to take too much time. I think a lot of us probably have some memory going back to childhood or from our parents, you know, of somebody standing over a hot canning kettle for, you know, 3 weeks in July, you know, and think, oh gosh, I could never do that. And so one of the things that I did, and it was take a lesson from Carla Emery, who wrote the all-important book, The Encyclopedia of Country Living. It's a great book, and it just covers almost everything you could possibly want to do to grow food and preserve it. But what she says is, I try to do something every day. She says, when it's from the moment I can work the soil, I try to plant something every day. And from the moment the first crops come in, I try to harvest something every day. And during the season, I try to put something by every day. And now, not everybody's going to do something every day of all of those things. But what I sort of took from this is it doesn't have to be all at once. It doesn't have to be a huge project. It doesn't have to make you crazy. So you can put on and make a few pints of jam while you're helping your kids with their homework and making dinner. And you can slice up some apricots and throw them in the dehydrator, or pick up the potatoes and put them in the basement and do, okay, I did that today. And one of the great things about that is that stuff really, really adds up, and it adds up a lot. And it's one of those things where I think if you look at it as a big, huge project, you're never going to get started. And if you break it down to, I could spend 10 minutes a day or an hour a week working on this and have some real results, then I think it becomes much more manageable.
Hmm. Well, I've got a long ways to go in getting the amount, 3 months of food you recommend, getting that put aside. But doing something small every day sounds like something I could do.
Exactly. And, you know, you can pick up a little more every week and things, and suddenly you'll realize, oh my gosh, I really do have this food that I need.
Hmm. Now, one of the recommendations you make in Independence Days is not to try to reproduce the supermarket diet, but try to connect your food storage to the local food systems. We got about a minute left. Could you explain, Sharon Astick, the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, we're talking about local food is really important. We need to invest our dollars in the right places. And so what I think is we need to shift our diets towards what's really well produced in our area. The supermarket tells us we can have anything we want, anytime we want. But in fact, the reality is wherever we live, we're going to start eating the foods that grow well there. And if we shift our diets towards, say, more corn and potatoes, more milk that grows well in Vermont and New York, then we'll find that we're able to eat more sustainably and probably more reasonably.
Hmm. Very good. Well, Sharon Astick's latest book is Independence Days, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation. It's available in locally owned independent bookstores everywhere. Sharon, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
So there are some possible Christmas gifts to your friends or your family or yourself. Permaculture Magazine, we talked about at the beginning of the show, or Sharon Astick's new book, Independence Days. There are links to both of them on our website, equaltimeradio.com. And if you don't have at least 2 weeks of food on hand for an ice storm or some other emergency, some of the first things that Sharon advises you picking up is some extra oats or rice or beans. Next time you're shopping, you can just do that your next trip to the store. Could be glad to have it during an ice storm, and you'll have a full pantry to extend a welcoming table to unexpected visits of friends. And thanks to Sean from Warren for the call, giving us the information about the Montpelier Winter Farmers Market, first and third Saturdays up at Vermont College. I believe it's 9 to 1, but it might be 10 to 2. Go after 10 o'clock in the morning, and you're sure to find it. I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. We'll be talking about the Copenhagen Climate Talks, what people are doing right here in Vermont as well to be part of the solution. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travis and I host. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
It's December, time for Christmas sales and holiday shopping. There are a lot of people arguing that we can live happier, more fulfilling lives while spending less money and having fewer material things. How does that work for Christmas shopping? Do-it-yourself gifts are a time-honored tradition. My dad, as sort of a useful joke, cuts up scrap paper and staples it together into homemade notepads. It's a start. Probably you have skills that allow you to make somewhat more elaborate gifts. Another tradition is coupons for services. Why not make those coupons for services that teach a person to fish, rather than services that give a person a fish? That is, instead of offering babysitting time or to make bread for people, valuable things those, but offer to show someone how to make bread, help them plant a garden, mend a ripped garment, build something, whatever you know how to do. If you're going to purchase something, you can buy something at the thrift store or consignment shop. It will stretch your dollars, and it turns other people's junk into resources. That's a skill that will become increasingly useful as energy scarcity keeps the economy in the doldrums. You can even turn your own junk into resources for others at the same time. The Transition Town movement in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, is organizing a holiday regifting swap. They encourage people to, quote, bring items of quality, toys, housewares, knickknacks, art pieces, homemade crafts, books, candles, glassware, furniture, games, music, homemade jams, hats, scarves, mittens, coffee mugs, lamps, art supplies, and whatever else you can think of. Another wonderful thought is wrapping paper. If you are a hoarder of old wrapping paper, this is your opportunity to lighten the load, unquote. How does it work? The organizer says, quote, all items will be placed on display. They are being given away, so don't bring things you want to sell or do individual trade for. Then we will simply browse the wares and take whatever items strike our fancy, unquote. Another alternative is to donate in other people's names to nonprofits doing important work, teaching people how to live a fulfilling, happy life with less money and less energy, or promoting local food and the local economy, for example. Do you feel strange about giving something used to someone or donating in their name? The golden rule applies. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. It's not too late to let people know that you want donations or used or homemade items as gifts. Or you could buy people new things that encourage greater self-reliance. John Paul Flintoff's new book is about how he searched for meaning in his life until he started making and mending his clothes on a treadle-powered sewing machine. It's called Through the Eye of a Needle. Sharon Astick's new book, Independence Days, tells how to preserve food, but it's also a fun read about life. And there are old standards like Helen and Scott Nearing's Living the Good Life. If the people you give these things to don't like them, they can re-gift the books to someone else. I'm Carl Etner, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.